gather that's the way to get the tape recording attention. Good morning. Let's assume they have it on now, and I'm supposed to do a bit of introduction for the sake of the tape. I'm Roger Field. I live and work in the Twin Cities area. I'm going to be working this week with some themes from American intellectual history as they relate to the witness of the gospel. So the title, for what it's worth, the title we'll be working with is The American Mind and the Witness of the Gospel. And you heard it announced this morning that today's particular topic will be, in the beginning, a new world and a new mind. Now, let me ease my way up to that and start the way we ought to start, and that's in prayer. We ask you, Father, we who are both people of God and people of a particular nation and place, we ask you to help us to understand who we are, what it is we are about. Help us to be aware of what has shaped us and equally aware of our obligation to serve as your instruments in shaping your world. For we ask it in your name. Amen. I'd like to use an illustration as a way of telling you something about my commitments, and that will tell you in turn, I hope, something about the theme and the way we're going to be working. I'm a product of an Iowa farm out of Haugian Norwegian background, small town, one of those big high schools of graduating class of 20. I went to the University of Iowa, and somewhat by coincidence or the working of the Spirit, whatever, I ended up in a course called Contemporary Protestant Thought, taught by George Forel, Lutheran theologian on the School of Religion faculty at the University of Iowa. I need to tell you about the experience of that class. It is not clear to me what I really expected going into that classroom. I'd been at the university long enough that I knew something about the style of the place, but certainly nothing about the style of Forel. We walked into that class, perhaps 100 of us, the first day of that semester, and he handed out a reading list. I'll check off the books quickly for you. And just the fact that I remember them 28 years after the fact says something about them. Brave New World, 1984, No Exit, Fear and Trembling, Death of a Salesman, Grapes of Wrath, Screwtape Letters, a series of those kinds of things. Streetcar Named Desire, they keep coming back. The Loved One, Evil and Woz, story about an animal cemetery and crematorium. Forel handed this reading list out, said to the 100 of us in less than 5 minutes' time, we're not going to have class for the next 3 weeks. And the reason we're not is that there's no point in having class till you've read all these books. So we went home and read the books. Came back after 3 weeks, and his introduction then to the first serious lecture was to say something like this. There is no point in talking about contemporary Protestant theology unless you have first developed a passionate commitment to understand the needs of your contemporaries. There is no point in talking about theology in the absence of a commitment to the needs of people around you. In the years since that, both experience and study have confirmed for me how important that was, that it is terribly important that we understand minds, mindsets, our minds and the minds of those to whom we are trying to witness or with whom we are trying to live and serve. I fear that we and our churches, and I say that as somebody who works in a national church office, so I'm aiming at myself as much as anyone. I fear that we and our churches fail precisely at the point of cultural interface, that when it is said of us that we don't care enough about witnessing to others, the chances are that that masks another fact, and that is that we do sometimes care, but are frustrated by not knowing how to care or how to reach or how to find the point of interface. It is sometimes that we can't get hold of our the minds of those to whom we are trying to witness. Sometimes it's worse than that. It's as though we are of two minds ourselves, caught sometimes in a kind of a webbing without being able to be very clear about the webbing. So when the theme says the American mind and the witness of the gospel, my hope is that we will be able to talk about the shape of the American mind, of ours and of those around us, that we'll be able to talk about that in a way that helps us to understand the intersections. And I use intersection deliberately because it can be a friendly place or it can be a place of calamity. The intersections between the mind of the American and of the witness of the gospel. Let me try to sharpen the question, and just an aside, if I may. I hesitated to spend half of the first session trying to lay groundwork, but I hesitated even more about trying to charge ahead without doing that, so I'm going to risk laying a lot of groundwork. Let me sharpen the question. I believe we need to know how most people think and feel, that we need to try to find out what's kind of common about the thought patterns and processes of most people at our own time, that we need to discover what values most Americans count valuable. I'm more than willing later to talk about how we have to be world citizens and not only American ones, but I'm going to start with this piece. What values Americans count valuable? We need to do that not as a marketing device. I'm aware that some of what I'm about to do is not terribly different than what political pollsters do in trying to tell unscrupulous candidates what things to stand for in the next election. That's a marketing device. We need to do it not as a marketing device, but out of a servant understanding of our calling. I think that's the understanding of the phrase that we must be wise as serpents but innocent as doves. The innocence has to do with motive. If we are to be good stewards and effective witnesses, we need to learn to listen to the heartbeat of our own culture, to the vital signs of our own times. We need to be able somehow to unpack it and say, what is this we believe and feel and think? We need to analyze the values, the beliefs, the patterns of thoughts which come to all Americans as a common inheritance. And in saying that, I don't want to deny that there are also some special inheritances or some sub-inheritances, subcultures, subsets of values. I'm not suggesting that we are a herd or a mass and that we are only described in terms of something that's common to us all. But there is a very large body of common inheritance. And it is that which I hope we can look at in these, at least this week together. I'm going to keep an open mind about what we do next week. That the goal is to better understand the cultural or the intellectual price we pay for being Americans today, and then to compare and contrast that mindset with the values, the beliefs, the patterns that are offered to us who are described by Scripture as being en Christo, in Christ. Behind that way of asking the question are some assumptions which I'd better declare, because if I don't, you'll sense them and wonder. One of the assumptions is that we are not aware enough of the particular ideas and processes which have shaped us as Americans. If you want to say that some other ways, it's that we tend to think that the way we think is the way everybody thinks, or at least the way everybody ought to. Isn't it, after all, the right way to think? We are not aware enough that we have been shaped, or to borrow language from next week's material with McLuhan, we've been massaged, we've been worked over by some rather peculiar kinds of things in this new world. The danger is that we have absolutized whatever is the current mindset, that we have become prisoners of a particular way of thinking without being able to recognize how transient a mindset is, and how relative all mindsets are. I'll try to define mindset after a bit. To borrow language from 1 Corinthians 13, we see through a mirror darkly, but we have tended to think that we see clearly. Or to say it another way, we tend to think of ourselves as being innocent, when in fact what happens is that we are innocent in the worst sense, innocent in the sense that we are too close to ourselves and thus too far removed both from our own past and from our neighbors, the world around. Innocent in the sense of naivete. If I were to pick illustrations, two of which I'm sure of, and the third I'll hazard, and then you can react if you want later on. The stereotypical illustrations of that kind of miasma, of not being able to see well enough, the stereotypical illustrations are Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. I'm sure that's why Forel put that at the top of the reading list. Or Archie Bunker in Norman Lear's All in the Family. Or, and this one I hazard for your contemplation, I think Howard Cosell is a stereotypical illustration of the problem of believing that however you see things is the right way to see them and the only way to see them. Nobody preaches more without a license in America than Cosell does. Now the question really becomes, how best do you unlock a contemporary mindset? And now I better define mindset. Mindset is a characteristic framework of understanding. It's the way you set up your mind to perceive realities. It's the structure of belief, or the characteristic ways that you hear things or see things, depending on whether you're an auditory or visual kind of person, or both. It's the characteristic questions you ask, the anticipations you carry with you, not so much your value system, that's content, but mindset is a structure. It determines what you see and what you don't. Sometimes it determines what you read and what you don't. It's your way of coming at things. And if you've read Toffler in Future Shock, you know that what he said at that point was, what happens when too much of the webbing gets torn away, when that characteristic framework gets assaulted? Well, I'm not going to go into the Toffler material, but mindset is that webbing you put together, that way of looking at things. How do you best unpack it? Forel's entree with me some 28 years ago was through literature. And he used that, and I would love to use it, but I'd have to do some more work on it to get contemporary again. He used that on the assumption that artists get to the future first, and that they are able to see things that are already present for them but still future for us, or that are present for us but we don't see them yet. There are other art forms you can use the same way as vehicles. If one is a good student of painting or a student of music, or I love to work sometimes with current television or with movies as ways of trying to unpack it. But what I'd like to do this week is to introduce you to the style of getting at the current mindset through what has been labeled intellectual history. That's a field I'm trained in. It's a field I'm excited about. I'd like to use it as source and tool this week. American intellectual history, the history of our experience done in terms of the intellect of the American, not of the events, the wars, the economics so much, but of the mindset, of the ideas. Let me say it carefully. Intellectual history is not the study of intellectuals. I don't propose to do that this week. But rather, it is the study of the intellectual content of most people. The content of their ideas, their beliefs, their values, their biases, our beliefs, values, biases. It's the study of the origin of ideas that we now hold or that now hold us, of the development of those ideas, of the changes. Tomorrow I'll trace some ideas that change so much that you're surprised to discover that it's still the original idea after all the stuff it's gone through. The change and the possible decay of ideas as dynamic forces in the lives of people. What we'll be doing mostly is studying pieces of American history that I suspect are familiar to you. We'll be studying old and known material with new questions. Sometimes, unfortunately, I'll be bringing answers to the materials and not just questions, which is an improper way to do history, but that hasn't stopped any of us from doing it that way. That we'll be approaching old material with new questions, And that often what will be happening is what the technicians call revisionist history, revising the outcomes of a standard set of data. Or that often what you'll hear from me is intentionally relative and often tentative and not very often conclusive. And you will sometimes walk away from an idea, or I will walk away from it, and you'll say, hey, wait a minute, that's not complete yet. And sometimes it'll be because I haven't communicated well. Sometimes it's because it's not completable yet. It's still in process. Behind that, that whole thing is another assumption. That's that ideas have a life of their own. That whatever their origins, ideas have consequences. We are not an idea-less people. We are surrounded by them. We are infilled with them. But ideas have a life of their own once they get started. They tend to hang on, to hang in would be better language. They tend to hang in and keep a hold on us. And so there is no such thing as a kind of a fixed and permanent mindset. And in that sense, I already have to modify a definition. Mindset really is what's held at any given time by a large group of people. But what happens is that mindsets themselves are always changing, not always growing, but always changing. Some historians use the language about climates of opinion, and I think that's a good kind of language to use. We are at any given time dominated by a particular climate of opinion, not necessarily a majority climate. One needs to be careful here. An idea can hold us which would never draw the votes of a majority, but which is very powerful, very persuasive. It does direct things, even though it is held by a minority. One of the neat little pieces of correspondence out of the early American Revolution is reported by Charles Adams, the brother of the more famous Adams. This brother was the one who was involved in managing the committees of correspondence that were trying to fan this whole thing into flame. And somebody asked Charles Adams in about 1774 whether he really believed that most of the 4 million colonists believed the way these radical independence people thought. And Charles Adams writes rather frankly back, and he says, no, they don't, not yet. Now that's what climate of opinion is. It was becoming a dominant idea even though most people had not yet come to think it was important. And in fact, many of them never did. They simply went along with what that dominant climate of opinion was pushing. Well, it's in that sense that a climate of opinion is a current way of looking at things. It has probably pushed an older climate away, and the older climate has been ungracious about its leaving. So it's still there, and it's pushing. And it's probably in turn being pushed by another either evolutionary or revolutionary kind of climate. So you've got all that kind of push and pull going that feels like just a whole range of opinions, but in fact there is a shape, there is a climate within. One of my favorite writers, Vernon Lewis Parrington, titled one of his books, Main Currents in American Thought. It's the main currents we're hunting for, not the little flurries on the side. Finally, let me just say what I understand this use of history to be, and I'm borrowing a definition from American historian John D. Hicks. Hicks says what this is a study of the present explained in terms of the past. That's what I hope we're going to do. I don't really want to spend your time and mine studying history for the sake of, gee, isn't that interesting? What I hope we can do is study the present explained in terms of the past. What I am aware of is that in the process, we would also tend to be shaping our memories of the past. That's what history does, among other things. The way we're going to proceed in so massive a subject is that I'll take only selected ideas. I won't try to do the whole thing. I don't know how to do the whole thing. I'll take selected ideas that are currently pretty potent in the American mind, and I'll try to trace their origins, their development, the present shape or shapes. Sometimes ideas have more than one shape. Sometimes the shapes don't even agree with each other. But I'll try to trace them through. and then try to suggest the intersections between these strands of American thought and the message of the gospel as we understand it. Well, let's see, we started at 10:45. That means I did get that introductory stuff out of the way in half the time, and that I feel good about. All right, in the process, I won't feel badly if you also develop an interest in the subject matter that I'm calling American intellectual history, and if some of you either already have that as a special interest or want to pursue that in smaller discussions, I'd be delighted and would be happy to talk bibliography with you and a bit more of the kind of conceptual background. But for now, I'd like to get into subject matter tracking some of those ideas. And in the process, let me then just talk very briefly about one of the three books that are on the bookshelf in the bookstore as suggested reading. Martin Marty is the writer, the Lutheran theologian and writer. The book is called Righteous Empire, The Protestant Experience in America. The cover over there won't look quite like this one. It's been reprinted so many times, and the cover changes, but not what's inside it. A few words about it. This is church history. You're not going to hear much church history from me. I'm more attracted to what was going on in the common mind than what was going on in the churches in the past. But if you want to get a feel for the church history that lies alongside it, this is just a super book. The only limitation it has is the one Marty describes himself in the introduction, and that's that since it was part of a bicentennial history project by, I suppose, Doubleday, wasn't it? I had to look and see. No, the Dial Press published this one. Since it was part of a series, the editors of the series imposed the framework that it was to deal with the 200 years of American corporate history from 1776 to 1976. And of course, starting at 1776 is to start terribly late in the American experience. So Marty says at the beginning, you have to realize that I've left out whole buckets of important things because of the editorial requirement to start with the Declaration of Independence. But read it with that kind of limitation, I think you'll find it just a delightful book. All right, let me try to apply the approach. By the way, I'll introduce the other two books, one of them tomorrow and one next week. Let me take a first look at ideas that have shaped us. It'll help you to know which three we're going to deal with on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. So let me declare those now and then come back to the ones I'm not going to deal with those days. The three ones that are coming up as kind of main themes or main currents. Tomorrow, we're going to look at the Puritans. I'll title it Visible Saints or Common Sinners, the Puritan Legacy. And what I'll really be saying is that Puritan ideas are terribly important to the American mind, perhaps the most dominant strain of intellectual activity that has shaped us. On Thursday, I'll put two other pieces together that fit only sort of together. Thursday, the commitment to independence and the quest for community. And what we'll be talking about there are the almost countervailing thrusts, one toward independence, which tends to isolate, and one toward community, which tends to integrate. And then on Friday, trying to take a look at the economic ideas that have moved us as a people, I'll talk about the myth of the self-made man and the progressive vision. Okay. Now, briefer reference to some other themes from out of our past. By the way, have any of you seen The Legend of the Lone Ranger, the new movie that's out? It isn't going to win many awards, but if you ever did what I did as a kid and sat in front of one of those big old radios with a jar of raisins and listened to The Lone Ranger and then the other series of things, The Legend of the Lone Ranger is not a bad way to get hold of some mythology. Not just about the Lone Ranger, but really about the American people. I commend the movie. It's got enough blood and guts in it that you may want to decide whether to take your kids, but it's not bad to see. From out of our past, you can hear that out of the old Lone Ranger thing, some themes that are still influential in the American mind today. And what I want to do is a cluster that will end up sounding like either two or three ideas, depending on how it sounds to you. The first one I want to try to talk about is the European connection. and how it has shaped and is shaping us. If you want a book that does this more in detail, it's Daniel Boorstin, who is now the librarian of the Library of Congress, but who for a long time was a historian with, at one time, enough leftist leanings that he worried Senator McCarthy. Daniel Boorstin's book is America and the Image of Europe. It's not a big book, but it's a good one. I'll try to kind of lift a bit of that out. And I'm leaving out the whole Puritan chunk, so it's just keep that in suspension. What I want to say about this is that the American mind has been strongly influenced by its European roots, but that the influence has not always been a friendly one, that the relationship has been ambivalent, and sometimes it's gotten to be a downright love-hate kind of relationship between the American mind and our European roots. On the one hand, there has been a strong sense of connection. You catch it best in the phrase, the New World. And that's why I picked that as part of the title this morning. In the beginning, a new world and a new mind. When you call this the New World, it's that's a very strange language. It does not describe geological fact, I don't think. I don't think it's any newer than the rest of the globe. So it's not new in that sense. And from a Native American perspective, there was nothing new about it. It's New World only for people who came out of a world they wanted quickly to declare old. And those happened to be Western Europeans. You hear it echoed like a refrain in the names they gave to the places they settled. New Amsterdam, which then became New York, New Jersey, New Haven, New Bedford, New Britain, New Rochelle, New Brunswick, Virginia, which is has a kind of a mixed bag. It's both named after the Virgin Queen and after the Virgin Land. So it has both of those senses of newness. There's Newton and Newburgh and Newport and New London. And you can, if you lay out an atlas, particularly of New England and Virginia, and bits of New Jersey and parts of eastern Pennsylvania, it reads like that kind of a descriptor of this sense of newness. And then, if it was not to use the word new, it was to faithfully take an old name and put it in a new place. They had a Cambridge and a Manchester and a Worcester and a Plymouth. Or they brought people's names, a Jamestown and an Elizabeth, and then you can go on like that. Later on, a Georgetown. Later waves of immigrants, though they came to an already settled land, did some of the same thing. You hear about a Berlin, Wisconsin, or a New Prague, Minnesota, or a Bismarck, North Dakota, or a Norway, Iowa, or a Victoria, British Columbia, and the line goes on. And then when those waves of immigrants talked about their coming here, they either talked nostalgically or contemptuously about the old country. You know, it depended on the time and the mood of the new land, whether it was nostalgia or contempt. But whether they were talking about Norway or Ireland, the old country had a certain feel about it. It was a way of saying, we're not there anymore. We're in the new land, a new world. By the way, they didn't call it a new land. They called it a new world. And, you know, that's just a cosmic kind of phrase when you think about it. So on the one hand, they were attracted. There was a sense of connectedness with Europe. They were Europeans in a new world. On the other hand, there was a sense of escape. Many of them came thinking of themselves as good men. You'll never get the literature to say and women because it just was not willing to deal with that. Women were kind of attached and came along or weren't attached and didn't come along. It's always good men. They thought of themselves as good men who had been hindered by corrupt societies in Western Europe. I'm including the British Isles in Western Europe. Had been hindered by a corrupt society, or by lack of social mobility, or by lack of economic opportunity. When you look at who came and why they came, not just the earliest ones who went to Plymouth or Jamestown or Massachusetts Bay, but most of the waves who came, clear until, now here's where it gets a little tricky to draw the line. My own thinking is that you can describe you can pretty well describe common attributes to almost all the immigrants who came prior to the German potato famines and the Irish crises of the 1840s. Anybody who came before that, and even after that, those who came from the Scandinavian countries and to some extent from North Germany, you can describe them in not in terms of their having been at the bottom of the heap in Europe, but in fact they were a very aggressive, restless, ambitious group. They tended to be the second sons of well-to-do families, or they tended to be people who didn't think they were going to have enough land to farm because of the antiquated ways that they divided estates, or they just simply had this internal kind of push and were not content to stay. They were escaping from what was for them a stifling kind of situation. What stifled them varied. It could be the sociological situation, it could be a family situation, it could be an economic one. What was common was they felt stifled, they felt held in, and the idea that there was a new world, virgin land, that was an attractive pulling kind of thing. And it's not till the 1840s and after, and then only primarily with the Irish and the Central and South Germans, and then not until the 1870s in terms of the Mediterranean ring and East European one, it's not till then that you have people who were being pushed by things behind them. Up till then, it was mostly people who were being pulled by what they sensed was available in the New World. They reminded themselves of how important it was to beware of foreign entanglements, and they quickly made clear that by foreign entanglements, they did not have Canadians and Mexicans and Cubans in mind, they had Europeans in mind. The Monroe Doctrine draws a line right smack down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And what it says is the old world makes such a mess of things that it ought not to come over here and repeat the mess. We will manage ourselves. We are better people. Often that sense of escape got caught in religious language, both by religious people and sometimes by not-so-religious ones who still had the habits of language around. When you hear of a city named Providence, or New Haven, or Bethlehem, or Salem, or Philadelphia, or New Hope, you're hearing the language about a people who sense that they have escaped, and that they've not only come to a new world, but that they are a new people. Now, that's the piece I really want to get at. That in the process of coming, they were becoming a new people. They were no longer Europeans. They didn't think of themselves. If you ever play the game about pronouns, when people say they have dissociated themselves. When we say we are incorporating. And they language very quickly became the language of description of Europe on the part of new Americans. They, that country, those people, that sort of feeling. Out of that, very quickly, came a sense of native superiority. Native, that is to say, natural superiority. That while Darwin comes a whole 200 years later and then was rejected on the American scene for a very long time, there was a practice of Darwinism by people who'd never heard of the possibility. That was the idea of a natural selection. The best people came, and the not-so-good ones stayed behind. Now, in the Puritan thing tomorrow, I'll do a lot more with that, so put some of that in suspension. But let's say a little about it now. There was a sense that they were or were becoming the best people. That phrase, by the way, shows up in Protestant literature of the 1800s and all the way up through the Prohibitionist controversy, clear into the final repeal in 1932. The journals and the churches that fought for Prohibition and against repeal were the ones who, two generations earlier, had fought for abolition of slavery. And prior to that, there were a lot of other kinds of causes they got involved in. But the characteristic phrase that shows up without any sense of the irony of it or the inappropriateness or arrogance of it, the phrase is the better people. And it was a shorthand phrase that typically meant The Anglo-Saxon, by which that doesn't mean just British Isles, that really means Teutonic, German, even French if they were willing to learn the language and forget about French Canada. The kind of Northwest European types became the better people in the sense that they were Anglo-Saxon, they were Protestant, and they were, by and large, rural. You know that at the time of the American Revolution, still only 4% of our population lived in cities, and that the turnover, the 50% line, doesn't show up till 1870 or after. Our roots are so tremendously rural, and there was a kind of an American version of the Prussian land myth that really good people live on the land, and those who can't make it on the land will have to grub for it in the city. There was that sense that the city was the bad place. They came, they settled, they developed for themselves. Now I think I need to change the language. We developed for ourselves, even though my roots in this country don't go back before 1852, but I'm so much a part of it that I think it has to be we. Our roots had such a sense of native superiority, of both better people and better opportunity, that we developed a kind of a legacy of relative innocence about ourselves. We were less guilty. We were less futile. We didn't mess things up so badly. We saw and see ourselves as having the best of Western European institutions and bloodlines, but free from the worst of Europe's liabilities. Faculty member at the University of Minnesota who has become a favorite of mine, David F. Noble, American intellectual historian, wrote a book that unfortunately only survived one printing. It took so long to sell that the publisher wasn't willing to reprint, so I can only give you a title and hope you'll look it up in a library sometime. But a marvelous book. He calls it The Eternal Adam and the New World Garden. The Eternal Adam and the New World Garden, 1971 publication date. He says what happened was that the founding fathers, now founding fathers doesn't mean the 1776 bunch, it means the 1619 and 1628 bunch, Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay, particularly Virginia to some extent. The founding fathers, the people who first came and had to develop their sense of who they were in this country, that they quickly took on the biblical imagery of being a new Israel. You'll find that language just shot throughout pre-revolutionary literature, and you'll find it all the way up into Melville and Dickens and Hawthorne, just littered with the sense of the new Israel. And in some senses, you still find it in American literature today. They used language about the wilderness. And they identified with Moses and the wilderness, except they had no one leader. So they had no Moses, but they had the sense of having gotten out of a land of slavery, having escaped from a bad place, and being in the wilderness, but not wandering in it. They did not think of this wilderness as a threatening place. It was also the promised land. What would convert the wilderness into a promised land was to settle on it, was to tame it, to domesticate it. Perhaps I've said enough about that theme. Let me trace the other one, then it's your turn. The other idea, and it'll sound closely related, that has had strong influence on the American mind is the existence of a frontier. We have been surprisingly and powerfully shaped by the fact that when this nation was developing its sense of itself, it had an open frontier. And conversely, with the closing of the frontier, the loss of the frontier in 1890 and following, some of the basic problems of the American mind and the American process have become more obvious. If you hear me using frontier, let me identify the source. Frederick Jackson Turner, American historian, in a presidential address to the American Historical Society in 1893, I think it was, two or three, developed a thesis that has now come to be called the frontier thesis. His thesis was that the kind of people we are, the kind of values we have, the kinds of institutions we have built, have been powerfully shaped by the fact that there was a frontier, that there was always a place where there were not people, and we had found ways already to describe the Indians as non-people. So there were not people on the frontier. And that that served as a powerful kind of shaper, and that conversely, the closing of the frontier meant the closing down, the end of the newness of the new world. Let me try to spell those implications out. I think Turner argued, and I think it's very helpful insight, that the frontier attracted certain types. Let me take a piece of our mythology. Now, let me back up. Need to introduce another term, one that historians call the enabling myth. An enabling myth is that sometimes you create a myth when you need it as a way of giving yourselves permission to do something you desperately want to do. And one of the enabling myths, and by the way, those myths always had some element of truth in them. What usually was wrong with them was the way they were used. There was some truth to it. The enabling myth I want to get at right now is the one that had to do with the goal of the settler. The enabling myth said the goal of a settler was to find a claim to land that had not yet been claimed by anyone else, to prove up on it, to build a house, to break the sod, to develop the livestock and so forth, and then live there the rest of his life. If you want to have fun sometime, go to a county recorder's office. Take a look at how long the first owners lived on most any farm in most any state of the Union. Not very long. Normally only long enough to prove up on it. And then the restlessness that led them that far led them the next step. Somebody the other day, and I can't remember the context, quoted from a Swedish journal, a Swedish-American journal, a woman saying of her father, When it got to the point where he could see the smoke from a neighbor's cabin, he decided it was getting too crowded and we moved again. And if you want to see that in another kind of illustration, take a look at Little House on the Prairie. Not so much the TV series where for artistic necessity they stay in the same community the whole time, but the story that's behind it. What's her name? Laura Ingalls Wilder, yeah. If you read her own material about this father, this Michael Landon type, who just kept kind of rolling around because he didn't really want to stay in one place. That's a piece of it. Frontier attracted certain types, the lean and the aggressive, not what Emma Lazarus much later on describes as the tired, the poor, the restless masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. When those started to come, we imposed immigration quotas. Those were not the people who headed for the frontier. They never had a chance to. What the frontier did for us was to magnify the importance of ownership and exploitation. Exploitation doesn't have to be a bad word, and I'm using it fairly neutrally right now. It promoted the sense of ownership and development, if you want to use that. But what's also important and was not so recognizable then was it siphoned off malcontent. If people didn't like it, they moved. And it legitimized restlessness. When there was a frontier, it was always all right to be restless. You could keep moving. And when in Grapes of Wrath, Faulkner tries to pick that up for the Dust Bowl days of the 30s, restlessness by then was a social liability. They can't stay in Oklahoma. They're getting pushed off by the big tractors and bulldozers. They're not wanted in California. So they get into labor camp trouble and all this kind of stuff. Restlessness was no longer in by the 30s. We called them hobos and worse. But it was in during all those frontier days. And that allowed otherwise irreconcilable persons, positions, points of view to avoid each other. For 200 plus years of our existence, those who didn't agree with each other didn't have to live together. The loss of the frontier from 1890 and beyond meant the end of the newness of the new world and exposed the flaws in the characteristic American mind. Two quick applications and then it's your turn. These will be very initial, very partial, very tentative, because I want to build on them in the next few days. First, the sense of being superior to the best of the rest of the world makes it difficult for Americans to conceive and practice a really inclusive fellowship. Instead, we have alternatively withdrawn from the rest of the world or entered the world mostly to instruct it. And I need to read a piece of Woodrow Wilson that Martin Marty quotes in the frontispiece of the book. Wilson, during the time that he was president, you remember that he's a product of a Presbyterian parsonage in Georgia of many generations in this country. He was not a New Jerseyite except for those years when he was a college president and then a governor. But this is the Georgia Woodrow Wilson, the Presbyterian talking. America was born a Christian nation for the purpose of exemplifying to the nations of the world the principles of righteousness found in the Word of God. That's pretty recent. That's 1914 that he said that. There was this sense then that either we withdrew from the rest of the world because it was inferior, or we entered it to instruct it. Even when Americans used with approval the phrase, the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God, it has always been elitist in our thinking. It has always meant if you become like us, you may join us. It has never meant including people who were dissimilar. And further, because most people came voluntarily to this country, this society of ours is steeped in voluntarism. We are a voluntary society in an extraordinary way, but most of our volunteering is not for servant purposes. The better people seek each other out in order to stay the better people. Second and finally, the existence of so much land and such rich natural resources provided overwhelming temptation to own and exploit rather than to serve and to be stewards of what God has given us. Thus, when it came to dealing with the Native American, those who came to the New World from the Old World, sometimes they did first and developed rationale afterwards, sometimes they rationalized first and then did what they had to do, but on the basis of lifestyle, settled versus nomadic, and of an economic style of ownership and agriculture, they found ways to dispose intellectually of the Native American, after which all they needed to do was to figure out how practically to dispose of them. And a dream developed and was pursued, which they hardly dared to dream in the old country. Sometime during the week, I need to cite some of my own kind of history out of Norway with that, but there's not time now. Another terribly important piece to pick out of this is that most of the social responsibility was either left behind in the old country or was shirked in the new The New World settlers did not very often quote the passage, "Leave the dead to bury the dead," but they clearly left the dead to bury the dead when they came here. Most never went back. And they did not bring with them those who were inadequate or helpless or couldn't pull their own weight. Matthew Fox, in the book that I hope you are reading as part of the theme one, A Spirituality Named Compassion, comes at that same kind of thing. Compassion was simply not part of the mindset of the people who came. And the other and a very tentative piece is just to say this. One of the results of the frontier, from a theological point of view, is that we have an extraordinarily low threshold of frustration, especially men do, in this society, a very low threshold of frustration. Because this was supposed to be the land of freedom and opportunity, and one ought not to get hemmed in by responsibilities. Let me then use just an illustration. How many of you have read C.S. Lewis's delightful little book, The Great Divorce? Enough have not, so let me just... It's not about marriage and divorce at all. It's about judgment. And the device he uses is to have both heaven and hell be places, and then have a gray line type tour that allows people to from one to visit the other and so forth. The piece I want to lift out right now is when a group from heaven take a bus tour to hell. And the scene that I want to lift out is when they arrive at the bus depot in hell. And it's very murky, almost, not pitch dark, but almost. They get off the bus, and there are no people around except the station master, and he's so owly that he's hard to deal with. But they do finally get a little bit of information out of him. They see that they're in a city because they can see the outlines of the buildings, but there are no lights on and no people around. And so they say to the station master something like, "We thought there were people in hell." "Oh, there are," he says. "Well, where are they? Why aren't they here? This looks like a city." "Well," he said, "they used to live here. But in hell, you can create a new home or house just by wanting it. You don't have to build it or buy it or any of that. Just want it and you can have it. When they lived down here, they lived so close to each other that they kept getting into fights. Each time they got into a fight, they moved out." And then he points out at the perimeter and he says, "You see an occasional light out there on the perimeter?" And they said, "Yes." He said, "That's where they live now. They have finally gotten far enough away from each other so they never have to deal with each other." That describes one of the pieces of the dilemma of the powerful attraction of the frontier. It attracted people who didn't want to have to live close to others, or at least who didn't want to have to adjust. It's your turn. I promise that most lectures I'll give more time for discussion. Felt like we needed to kind of move this one along.
Two ideas you mentioned earlier in your comments that the sort of male dominated, that the women were relevant and unimportant. Then at the end you talk about the frontier and the homestead, and this is probably also male dominated because your social historians will talk about the high rate of mental depression among the women and so forth.
Yes.
You want to comment on it?
Well, I just agree with you that there was that a woman tended to be dragged wherever her husband wanted to go. And you do see some of this in Little House on the Prairie. They mute it, but it's still there. Any number of women came single, as you well know, and sometimes they were recruited as potential brides. Sometimes they simply came for the same reasons that young men came. Some families came. But primarily very young people without children, or typically single people who then married. They were not necessarily loveless marriages, but they were marriages of convenience, if you can use that language. And the convenience was the convenience of the man. And while women's liberation was certainly not being written about or thought about very much then, the feelings, the set of frustrations, the denial of full personhood was clearly there. And that sense of being so dependent, what we prize as a past when marriages lasted for a lifetime, does not necessarily say much about people's love for each other. What it says was that one partner was always so economically helpless and socially helpless that there was no alternative. I don't know if that's getting at what you were after.
Roger, you?
Yeah, go.
You ended with being not able to adjust. And to me, that's really a key to a lot of what you were saying. And that you, everybody has values of some sort. And I guess what I'm, one of the questions I have is it seems implied in what you've said that perhaps we as Americans are less able to adjust than anybody else, and that's why we're rejecting them. But looking back to Europe, there are a lot of people there that couldn't adjust because their values were different, so they came over here. I think that that's probably universal.
Let me see. Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. I think it would be fair to say that Americans as a class, as a group, down through the ages, have been extraordinarily adjustable people. Part of the genius of the land has been our ability to adjust our institutions to match the opportunities. Enormous flexibility when we want to. The issue is not whether we can adjust. The issue has been whether we wanted to. And when in the years of World War I, and even before that, but it reached its zenith in World War I years, when we went at this business of 100% Americanism, when we tried to coerce people into jumping into the melting pot so that they would all come out homogenized Americans, I'm using Oscar Handlin's illustration now, what we were saying was, adjust to what we want you to be. The better people never wanted to adjust to what somebody else wanted them to be, and they never wanted to coexist alongside people who wouldn't adjust. So it was always a domineering adjusting. We are a very flexible people when we choose to be. But we have grown up with a mindset that says, but you don't have to in this land. You can be what you want to be. Am I getting at what you're after at all?
I think so.
I was just thinking of a book I read a while back called The Lively Experiment. I forget who wrote it, a fellow here from the University of Chicago, which talks about movement in space and the frontiers related to that. I think that we are still inheriting of that in terms of what we much often do in terms of getting away physically in space, and the whole RV movement is tied into that frontier. That somehow if I go out there and those trees, even though it's crowded with all the other RVs, getting away into new space, which then ties into the fact that I go to places where my values are then reaffirmed, whether that's walking through a shopping center or in the crowded campground, that's always in space, and I don't have to deal with different ideas as long as I have those people around me who are, I think, are thinking like I am.
Yeah, if you want to test that in another kind of illustration, just take a look at how much inconvenience people are willing to go to live far away from where they work in order to live in a homogenized setting.
Yeah.
The suburbanite, and then even beyond that, the exurbanite. I travel 18 miles by bus to get to my office. And the first 17, I'm very often tempted to say, the first 17 on the way home, I'm very often tempted to say, why on earth do we live clear out there? And then we turn the last corner into that quiet block with a half-acre lot. You know, I know why we live out there. That's a neat escape. Some more.
Just along the line of commenting on the notion of frontier, I think we've flipped the whole meaning of it, and it's indicative of the American mind. Because frontier has traditionally meant a stopping place. It's forbidding, it's foreboding, you do not go past the frontier. The frontier meant that you had to make do with what you had. The frontier was the limit. The frontier meant there is no more. But for us, it's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It means the next starting place.
Yep.
It means more land, more opportunity. It means the next challenge. It does not mean making do with what you have. It means getting more than you had before. And It's just quite a twist.
By the way,
and it continues. I mean, the slogan for the Kennedy administration was the new frontier.
The new frontier. That's right.
Space is a frontier.
Yeah.
And the whole notion that we are to conquer frontiers rather than live with limits,
yeah.
is a fantastic problem for us now, because now we're finding that there are frontiers that mean limits.
Yeah. By the way, soon after the frontier was officially declared closed by the Census Bureau in 1890, we found a way to open another frontier, and that was by taking on Spain over their New World possessions. McKinley, after manfully holding off the war fever for about 7 weeks, records that one day, I hope I quote this right, that one night he got down on his knees and prayed to God, and he said it came to him, not as a vision, but as an insight, that God also wanted our little brown brothers to have Jesus. And on that basis, we went to war, not just in Cuba, but in the Philippines. There is no logical way that you can argue that we had any business in the Philippines, except we needed new frontiers. And there is that sense. The Alaska business, there are lots of illustrations.
One fascinating to me aspect of this frontier mentality is the growth of the early Mormon church and the Old Testament themes of persecution, being in exile, that fostered the going to Utah and starting their own kingdom.
Yes, and of course that's just loaded with Israelite and wilderness and promised land kind of stuff. Well, we have to end here. See you tomorrow, I hope, and we'll go at the Puritans for a full hour. Try to do that more carefully.